You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. On the 1st of July 1960, a United States RB-47 reconnaissance plane was shot down by the Soviet Air Force off the Arctic coast of the Soviet Union. Four of the six crew members died. The shootdown occurred exactly 2 months after the far better known U-2 shootdown involving Gary Powers. I speak with John Mollison, an aviation artist, writer and award-winning filmmaker. Do check out his website at johnmollison.com. John interviewed Captain Bruce Olmsted, who was the co-pilot of the RB-47. As a result of his involvement in the incident, Olmsted received the Prisoner of War Medal in 1996 and the Silver Star Medal in 2004, as well as the Distinguished Flying Cross. His Silver Star citation reads, "By his gallantry and devotion to duty, Colonel Olmsted has reflected great credit upon himself and the United States Air Force." Bruce Olmsted died in October 2016. I'm delighted to welcome John Mollison to our Cold War conversation.
But you have to realize that we were flying RB-47 missions over Russia. These were in the 50s, and this was back in the day when Russia really didn't have the technology to intercept a high-flying RB-47. RB-47s were flying in the daylight, so they were able to outclimb and outrun a MiG-15. And this type of dog and cat Cold War recon trying to catch you was happening way before July 1st, 1960, when Bruce Olmsted was shot down over the Barents Sea, over international waters. The whole 50s and early 60s, up until, obviously, Gary Powers, which I think he was shot down May 1, 1960. That whole period of time was chock full of what are called SIGINTs, missions, signals intelligence. Now, being a nerd here, the listener needs to understand all these SIGINT, ELINT, COMINT, nomenclature that the military likes to create. If you look at SIGINT as an umbrella, underneath, you'll find the other ints, like comment, elint. Comment is signals intelligence that is usually has voice attached to it. Elint is communications intelligence that is largely data. So you think about voice would be maybe radio or some other kind of transmissions. And elint is radar or other kinds of, data moving back and forth. So SIGINT missions incorporated a number of aspects to try to basically collect intelligence around the enemy. And up until May, we were doing it with relative impunity. Of course, by May of 1960, we weren't flying too many RB-47 missions anywhere near Russia. We were using U-2s. And the RB-47 was flown around the periphery. We all know about Gary Powers being shot down in May of 1960 and how that happened. And
we cover Gary Powers and the 1960 U-2 incident in our episode number 23. There'll be a link in the episode information.
By July of 1960, July 1st, when Olmsted was shot down, Russia was highly agitated. And there's a whole story behind that. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, in this podcast.
Why was this information important to the U.S.?
The obvious looking for information on defenses and reaction times are part of signals intelligence. But we understand, we want to understand the big picture of what communications is about. And when in the Cold War, every bit of information is important. You want to know what their radar capacity is, their response times, where their bases are. Oh, there were still items that we didn't know. And so sometimes you're out there just sniffing, just figuring out what's going on. And electronic communications create all kinds of pathways and noise. And our job was to figure it out, find out when it's going, or find out where they're coming from, and figure out what it means.
You've spoken about the RB-47. For those that aren't familiar with that aircraft, can you just describe it and its a brief history and its capabilities?
First of all, you've got to think about the aircraft as probably one of the most beautiful airplanes you can ever look at. When I drew Bruce Olmsted's RB-47, I remember I was at the printer, and there's kind of a specialized process to printing these things. And the owner of the company was with me on the press check, and he came out and he looked at it and he said, "You know, that is so pretty. I just don't even believe it's real." And I'm saying, so you look at an RB-47, it's sleek. It's got this, you know, high mounted swept wing. And it really was the father to the B-52. B-52, of course, airplane that's still flying today. But give you a little background, the B-47 was a strategic bomber. And it had a crew of three, had a pilot, co-pilot, and navigator. And that was quickly supplanted by the B-52. However, the RB-47 was the reconnaissance version. And that airplane, I believe, flew from the 50s into 70s, early 70s. And it was a reconnaissance airplane. Now, if you look at an RB-47, you can always tell what they look like because there's you can tell it's an RB quickly because the nose is just slightly more blunt, and it's kind of got, it isn't as pretty, but it's black. And there are all kinds of little black squares, which kind of look like black, so little black squares on the fuselage and the nose. And those are the panels where there would be electronic listening gears, antennas, and receivers, and such. Here's the thing about the RB-47 that's fascinating to somebody who's not familiar with it, is that the bomb bay was filled with essentially a pod, and the pod was where these people called ravens were, and their job was to sit inside this pod with all their electronic listening measuring gear. And do their thing while the co-pilot, pilot, and navigator were up in their nose. So when you look at a picture of an RB-47, you're really looking not at a crew of three, you're looking at a crew of five or six, maybe even seven.
I have to take issue with you about the most beautiful aircraft from somebody who works at the Avro Museum, where the Avro Vulcan was produced from.
Yeah, I won't debate that. I think the Vulcan is pretty great, but I think you're, you British have great stuff. You have the XKE, you have the Spitfire, you have all sorts of wonderful things. Please give the most beautiful aircraft to the RB-47, and we can talk about something else now.
Okay, we'll agree to differ on that one.
All right. However, there's something about the RB-47 and the engagement on July 1 that to get further into the aircraft and into the moment with Bruce Olmsted and John McCone and Willard Palm and the three Ravens that were in the belly of this airplane, we've got to understand that at the altitude that this engagement happened between the MiG and the RB-47, RB-47 may be beautiful and sleek, but it's traveling very close to its absolute limits of being able to stay in the air. I work with a group called the Distinguished Flying Cross Society, and I know that the Brits have their version of the DFC, but in the DFC Society, I called up a good friend of mine. His name is Warren Eastman. He's not only a fighter pilot, but he's also an aeronautical engineer, PhD. And I asked him if he would help me get my head around the maneuvering envelope of an RB-47 at 30, 35,000 feet. So your listeners could understand what it was like to be, to have an aerial duel, this high and high altitude. And there was something, the critical Mach number and the stall speed on a RB-47 is very, very tight. And I asked Warren, you know, what the Mach number meant. And that's basically the maximum speed the airplane can go before it overspeeds the ability of the airframe to hold it together. The stall speed is the point where the wing loses lift. So it can be 5 knots or less between critical Mach and stall speed. So the true stall speed of an airplane, that increases with altitude. And as the airplane climbs, the air becomes less dense. The wings need more airflow. And as you climb, so your stall speed increases, and that's with any airplane. But you have to understand, 35,000 feet, 30,000 feet, which is about the altitude that this RB-47 was flying at on July 1, the MiG-19 comes up to it. That thing is it can't maneuver. I mean, it, you know, Warren figured, you know, geez, maybe you could get a 10-degree bank out of that thing, but they're sitting ducks. And the MiG-19 has a much more robust flight envelope than the RB-47 does.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
What altitude were they flying at?
They're flying above 30,000. The actual altitude is not known. But they, let's just call it between 30 and 35,000 feet.
They're flying to the Barents Sea. Now, that is north of Murmansk. It's that sea that's between Russia and, is it Novozelimia or something, the big island?
Yeah, it's north of Russia. Think cold, gray, you know, heaving. It's not a tropical destination.
No, not by any means. And where are they flying from? What's their home base?
Yeah, it was, and maybe, Ian, you can tell me here, Breeze Norton. It's kind of north and west of London, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the main RAF transport base in the UK now.
But in 1960, that is where, you know, some of the RB-47 flights were launched.
How long were these missions normally? Because that's quite a distance to fly and come back from.
Oh, they were very long. I mean, they go from 8 hours, 14 hours.
Which sort of does beg the question as to, did they have a loo on board these things or not?
Yes. The Ravens had what's called a chemical toilet, which just sounds horrible. But I would imagine if you were a Raven, you got to know your buddies pretty well, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, the Vulcan didn't have anything apart from a pee tube, a bucket of some sort. So nothing as luxurious as a chemical toilet. But anyway. Okay.
Well, you know, we Americans, we do things, you know, we got to do it right, right?
Yeah.
So ours had a lid.
You're going to have your own comforts.
Ours had a lid and chemicals. Made it all better.
Well, did the aircraft have any defensive armament?
B-47s were first produced with a 50 caliber machine gun, kind of a little stinger at the tail of the airplane. And the RB-47, they had 20 millimeter cannon. And of course, they had all the listening and passive passive radars on the airplane, but the Stinger and the tail was the only real defense the RB-47 had.
Had the Soviets harassed previous missions, or was this out of the blue, the attack?
There's a way to look at this act. On one hand, you can say the Russians are just being crazy. Why would they want to just shoot down this airplane over, again, international waters? But when I talked to Bruce Olmsted, this was in 2014, he was pretty clear with me. He said, you know, and we did talk about the mission. I got to know him as well as I think you could. He was pretty tired of talking about how he was treated at Lubyanka prison and what the actual shoot down was like. But Bruce had a really great military career in intelligence. And obviously he's flying an RB-47, so that's his mission, is military intelligence. So he filled me in on some details of the times. Now, you have to think about July 1, 1960, that's when Bruce Olmsted, Willard Palm, John McCone, and the Ravens are shot down. But you go back to May 1, 1960, that's the Gary Powers shoot down. And that was a U-2 over Russia. That was not international waters. But between, I think it was June 25th, 1960, and this is an important detail, there were two Americans who worked for the NSA that went to Mexico and then jumped over to Cuba and defected. Bruce Olmsted told me about this. He said what these two guys from the NSA had was a form of the PSYOP, which is the single integrated operational plan. Now, the PSYOP, it was essentially the nuclear war strategy for the United States that encompassed ICBMs, submarine launch missiles, and aerial delivered nuclear weapons. They call it the triad, the nuclear triad. And I talked to another Distinguished Flying Cross Society member, Ron Bartlett, who was the military attaché to the NSA. And I asked him, I said, so what is the PSYOP? And, you know, somebody defecting from the United States to Russia with the PSYOP, what would that look like? And he said, and he took me through, he said, John, do you know how much information is in the PSYOP? And he described the targeting, the time of attack, and all this stuff. He said, you know, wheelbarrows full of paper. But whatever happened in June of 1960, when these two guys defected, they probably had an aspect of the PSYOP or some information about our nuclear attack plans. You put this all together, and 6 days later, we're flying another sniffer flight again over international waters. The Russians are pretty irritated, and they're primed to fight. And God only knows what's happened in the communications between the two defectors and the Russians and through Cuba. And so things are heightened. Now, taking you to the flight path that's obviously coming in from the west and going along the northern coast of Russia. And there's an anecdote here I have to tell you, but you're flying this airplane single. It's not escorted, and in 35,000 feet, they're going to be intercepted. And when General Laughlin told me that when they did their overflights, albeit in the day in the 1950s, they were always attempted to be intercepted by MiG-15s. And the MiG-15 really didn't have the performance capabilities to be scrambled and then get the RB-47. And now remember, this is 1950s technology. So by 1960, we have the MiG-19, which is the next evolution. It's really, you can call it a Generation 3, is the first Mach supersonic fighter plane for Russia. It was shadowing the RB-47, Olmsted or Palm and McCone's RB-47, at a distance of about 3 miles. And this MiG-19 is being directed every step of the way by communications with essentially the base. So this MiG is tracking the RB-47. It's about 3 miles off. And General O'Loughlin told me that the Russians knew that the tail gun on an RP-47 had about a 41-degree fire angle, and they would stay just out of that arc, that area of lethality, so to speak. So if you can imagine, 1960, you got this top-of-the-line fighter. It now can reach the RP-47, whereas before the MiG-15s really couldn't. In time, and it's about 3 miles out. The RB-47 has all the electronic wizardry that we can put into the plane. Another reason for having this thing over international waters, I mean, if it got shot down, you don't want the Russians to be taking your cool kit, you know what I mean? So they were watching it from miles away, and remembering how Bruce talked about it, he said they knew the MiG was on scope, and of course the Ravens are watching this, and he goes, and then just disappeared. And moments later, minutes, I don't know how many minutes it was, wouldn't be too many minutes, but let's just say 5 minutes later, Bruce looked out over the starboard wing, and there was this MiG-19 40 feet away. It just kind of came right in. And it came right in so quickly and through through an angle that it was a total surprise. And Bruce remembered, the co-pilot's job on an RP-47 was, co-pilot, to manage the fuel and the engine performance. Again, you've got an airplane that is in coffin corner, as Warren Eastman told me about. This is a very narrow flight envelope. The guys in the cockpit are busy, and all of a sudden, the co-pilot now has to go into, well, I got to man the radar operated guns, the 20 millimeter Stinger in the back. But the MiG was so close that the radar scope that would aid in targeting was essentially just a big blob on the screen. You couldn't really target it. And so if you can imagine looking out on your wing, and 40 feet away is the Russian, and Bruce remembers seeing his face, everything about him, and he's just flying formation. And then he peels off and goes away. And then Willard Palm, the pilot, took the RB-47 in a very gentle, obviously again, because the airplane's at the edge of its stall speed, a very gentle turn to port, which later on they find out is right on path with a newly developed naval base that the Russians were trying to keep secret. You add in all the tension that's been happening in the past 4 months. Somehow, some way, the MiG pilot, he comes in guns blazing. It is a pursuit curve, and he lights him up, and he's got three 30 millimeter cannon. And Bruce starts firing back, and it's game on, and it's not a very long fight at all.
Does the pilot try and reduce altitude to try and get some more maneuverability, or does that first run in with the MiG-19 basically bring the aircraft down?
What happens next? The MiG-19 is coming in from the starboard, and I drew this. I got a little pencil sketch, and if you can make this part of the podcast somehow. Bruce Olmsted saw this and he said, yeah, that's what it looked like. So the MiG-19 has got a slight altitude advantage and is turning in fires, and his this cannon starts stitching up the left of the port wing. And if you can imagine looking at an RB-47, the cockpit is really just kind of a little bubble on the nose of the airplane. So Bruce, he's turned his seat to now essentially be the front-mounted tail gunner. And he's seeing this MiG-19 come in on a pursuit curve outside of the arc of the guns, the defensive guns of the RB-47. And Bruce is firing back, but there's some sort of glitch, lost radar, or lost the ability to really fire defensively. And the MiG, Bruce remembered seeing the nose of the MiG, you know, sparkle, and then the impacts on the wing. Now, a 30 millimeter cannon is a big shell. It's not a bullet. It's an explosive shell. And so when it starts hitting the wing, you've already got an airplane in this narrow flight environment. Palm pushes the airplane, the nose down, to get a little airspeed, but get away. But you're at that critical flight envelope that you don't want to go too fast. Then he'll rip your wings off. But you can't really stay there. So they're doing whatever they can. The airmanship of this crew is just at the edge. And they try to dive down. They lose control of the airplane. And I believe it was a couple thousand feet they lost. And then they tried to get they were able to get control of the airplane again, but then took another brace of fire and it was game over for the RB-47. And so they ejected. McCone ejected, Bruce ejected, and Palm ejected. And the Ravens inside, you know, they did have ejection seats in there, but they weren't able to get out. And if you can imagine the spinning and the G-forces inside that listening pod, it had to have been just chaotic. Surely the Ravens knew that a Russian plane was out there, and surely they could feel the hits. I don't know. Maybe they did eject. They certainly weren't found. Well, one body was found, Eugene Posa, and these are all officers. He was a captain. I think his remains were found, and the Russians didn't return them, but Dean Phillips and Oscar Goforth, the other two Ravens, they didn't find their bodies.
Was there communication between the Ravens and the cockpit?
There was. I wasn't able to get any of that from Bruce when I talked to him. He just said it was chaotic and you're in defense and everything is happening so quickly, and he didn't have any recollection.
So they're parachuting down into the Barents Sea, which is, as we've previously said, is very far from being a tropical sea. What happens when they land in the sea?
Well, I know that the pilot, Willard Palm, they figured he was dead when he went into the water. And the Russians did return his body August, September. And McCone and Bruce Olmsted, went into the water, and they got into their little dinghy boats that they had. So they had some sort of survival equipment, and they were obviously able to stay alive in the cold, cold waters. But Bruce Olmsted was severely hurt. He had some spine compression, and he had hurt his back pretty badly. And that happens sometimes in the ejection, let alone hitting a stormy sea. And Bruce was picked up by a Soviet fishing trawler that was sent out there. I think it was a motor launch from the fishing trawler, a little faster, little boat. And Ian, I believe John McCone was picked up later, shortly thereafter. And the two were the only survivors of the shootdown.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Did you get anything from Bruce as to how they were treated by the Soviet trawler crew?
I think pretty well. He just said, you know, you're picked up. He received medical attention, and you know, he was fed and warmed up. Obviously, very cool. At the whole time, Bruce was careful to tell me that he and McCone weren't physically tortured or abused. While they were at Lubyanka prison, they were not brutalized, and Bruce Olmsted received medical care for his injured back. But the death penalty was threatened, and that's a serious thing. And so you have to understand that Olmsted and McCone, they know that they're in a heightened environment. They're in a high-stress environment, you know, with Gary Powers and whatever else is going on in the world. However, while they were in captivity, both of them lost about 40 pounds apiece. So you can tell they weren't thriving, you know what I'm saying? And so they've got some, you know, sleep deprivation, they're being interrogated, and they've got sleep deprivation, they're being interrogated, and, you know, they're not getting the greatest nutritive care. You know, they're not getting good nutrition. Obviously, they're losing 40 pounds, and these aren't 21st century fat Americans. They're Air Force crew that are in shape. So we can only imagine they didn't have 40 pounds to lose. You see what I'm saying?
Were they subject to sleep deprivation?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what probably standard operating procedure for this kind of situation. Yeah, woken up, not given a whole lot of time to sleep, removal of time, so to speak, no clocks, in a cell with very little light, closed. Bruce did tell me that he figured he was two doors down from Gary Powers. And it should be known that Gary Powers was flying for the CIA, and McCone and Olmsted were flying for the Air Force. So, and there's some kind of unique ways that the Russians were treating him with that. So, because Olmsted and McCone were military, they were subject to the Geneva Convention, whereas Gary Powers wasn't.
So, the trawler guys bring them ashore, and they're transported, what, by train to Moscow?
Yeah, it was a planes, trains, and automobiles. They were a variety of transportation, but they were taken right away to Lubyanka. They were taken to Moscow. John McCone, the navigator, was in fairly good shape. Bruce Olmsted told me that he was in deep pain, and he was hurting. So, again, not at the hand of the Russians, more as a consequence of ejection and slamming into the ocean. But that has to be emphasized. I mean, Bruce emphasized it to me.
I guess the only information they disclosed was name, rank, serial number, and that was it.
Right, correct. As Air Force officers, Air Force crew, that's all that the Geneva Convention really, really required, and so they stuck to their guns, so to speak. The Russians felt we were definitely within Russian airspace. And John McCone, being the navigator on that airplane, he received special attention because he was blamed for the whole issue. You think about, you're the navigator, you should be able to know where you're at. And so John McCone got special attention, essentially, from the Russians. Now, again, the Russians knew we were over international waters, but you can imagine the sleep deprivation, the food deprivation. The fact that John McCone didn't break was extraordinary. And he stuck to his guns, stuck to his stuck to his confidence that they that he didn't make a navigational error. And that's important.
Until the Soviets reveal that they're holding these two, the Americans think there's been some mechanical failure of some kind, and they've come down in the ocean.
Yeah, yeah, correct. And we didn't know the RB-47 was shot down. It just goes blank. And that's how you have to realize what happened in those moments. The dogfight, this is something that happened very quickly. And, you know, so boom, you lose contact. And we didn't know what happened. And the next notice you have is you have an RB-47 shot down, and we have two of your crew. And that's quite a shock for the United States.
Once the Americans realize that the Soviets are holding them, what do they do? Do they try and enter into some form of negotiation with the Soviets?
First of all, you know, President Eisenhower, you know, pledged during the, after Gary Powers was shot down, that we would have no more overflights. So now we're conciliatory, even though the airplane was over international waters.
Well, I guess we don't know that at the moment, is that it could have overflown Soviet territory in error with a navigational error or bad weather or something like that. Yeah.
The Russian side of the game was that the RB-47 was 12 miles from the coast. Our navigation was that we were outside the 50 mile. So 50 miles is a lot different than 12 miles. And the Russians say that, of course, we were flying inside their borders. And of course, we weren't. But it also should be brought up again that when Willard Palm turned the airplane on a turn shortly before the attack, that we were headed for, at the time, what was an unknown top secret naval base. That may have been the provocation. I think it has to be established that the Russians were very nervous. They were extremely paranoid. And when the RB-47, you know, is making this turn and up ahead somewhere, 50 miles is still fairly close. And if you're traveling at 450 knots, well, if you've got a secret Russian base ahead of you and you're flying at 450 knots or something like that, you're going to be at that space fairly quickly. The Russians make a decision. They're going to shoot you down.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. How do the American negotiations proceed with the Soviets? How long are these guys held for?
208 days. McCone and Bruce Olmsted were kept in captivity. And I'm not that strong on what the negotiations were. But I do know that the Russians, threatened with, execution. So they have a trial. They're tried by the Russian courts. And in the end, the Russians decide not to pursue charges and let him go, which is essentially admitting, okay, yeah, you guys were in international waters, and we didn't have a right to shoot you down. you know, the Russians really wanted a confession. What they really wanted him to do was say, yeah, we were in the wrong, blah, 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 blah. That never happened. McCone and Olmsted kept their mouths shut, told the truth, and were returned in January, I think it was January 25th of 1961. And it was receiving them back into the country was the first act of newly elected President Kennedy. So you think about this, I mean, President Kennedy has been the president for a couple days, not very long, and his first act is receiving McCone and Olmsted back on American soil.
And does he try and take credit for that or not?
Well, of course, he's a politician, and he's going to want to take credit, but it wasn't highly promoted, although McCone and Olmsted were put on Time magazine. I mean, they're, you know, big cover. Then the story, or the version of the story, came out, and they were received by the president, the spouses. They got to meet Kennedy in the Oval Office, etc.
Now, in the photo you sent me, Kennedy looks rather bored by the meeting. Jackie looks a little bit more animated. It's an interesting study.
Yeah, I can't speak for President Kennedy at the time, but you can't separate the zeitgeist of the times from this whole event. I mean, 1960 has been a really tense year, from Gary Powers and then to having your NSA people defect with some semblance of American nuclear strategy. And then, of course, what happens, you know, a few months later, the Cuban missile crisis. This is an exciting time to be alive.
Well, even nearer, you've got the Bay of Pigs in April,
yeah.
I think it is, of 61. It's nervy times. And I think Kennedy has that meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna that year. Yeah. Right. As well, which doesn't go well. The Vienna summit was in June, and as if, you know, those incidents weren't enough, you've also got the Berlin crisis in 61 as well, which is that direct confrontation tank to tank at Checkpoint Charlie. So not a quiet year, I think it's safe to say.
The shoot down of Bruce Olmsted's RB-47 is more than just a footnote in history. I think it's part and parcel of the Cold War, which is, you know, your podcast. It's a fascinating moment, and it's something that should be understood. I think, again, today we think that the world has gone completely crazy and we're on this precipice. I think the great thing about studying history is that you start realizing that we've been on the precipice a number of times, but we continue to do so.
Were there many other shootdowns of U.S. aircraft by the Soviets during the Cold War?
When I interviewed Bruce Olmsted, it was probably the first Cold War scenario that I got to interact with a veteran. Again, I talked to the veterans, and I talked to them about more than just, you know, the moment in history. I want to find out their character, what kind of people they were, more of a leadership insight. But in learning about Bruce Olmsted, what I had to do was look at the bigger picture, and I think I think I came to 50 airplanes shot down in the Cold War by the Russians. And this, of course, would be from, you know, Japan wrapping around by Turkey and moving up to the Barents Sea. And Gary Powers was shot down near Sverdlovsk. So this is a shooting war that's very quietly kept.
What happened to Bruce and John McCone in their later careers? Did they remain in the Air Force? Or?
They did, and they both had great careers. I've met people that served with John McCone at Offutt Air Force Base. I think he was base commander at Offutt. And Bruce Olmsted stayed in the Air Force and had a number of appointments. And he retired, I think, in 1983 as a full colonel. And afterwards was content to sail. Yeah, good retirement. Bruce really was tired of talking about the Lubyanka prison, being shot down. But what he did want to talk about was the politics. He did want to talk about the citizenship of what it means to be in a country or in a world that's not always safe. And that was important to Bruce. So when he and I would have conversations, he would talk about the importance of secrecy and the importance of a nation's ability and practice of intelligence. He didn't regret one bit about the mission that he was a part of, because he knew that intelligence is vital, and he had a great respect for the idea of secrecy and duty.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.